Welcome to Let's Drive, SA's motoring podcast. In episode 4, it's all about the Lamborghini, the Huracan Evo 640, and the Urus. We also chat to Toyota Gazoo Racing South Africa navigator, Brett Cummins. And as always, it's the Let's Drive Top 5. Are you ready? Let's drive. Welcome to another episode of Let's Drive, your favorite motoring podcast in South Africa and beyond. The lockdown, it's almost over. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I can tell you what, two men who are extremely grateful to see this thing come to an end, near an end, are my esteemed co-hosts, Voldu van der Waal and Hannes Visser. Good morning, gents. Voldu, Hannes, how are you doing? Voldu, let's start with you.
Ah, Derek, when you said esteemed, I think you should have said extinguished, because at the moment there's not much driving going on, and I'm finding out very quickly that Gauteng is a much smaller place than I thought. This not crossing provincial borders thing is really driving me insane. But anyway, be that as it may, we're all surviving and cracking on, and at least we are back at work. So it could be worse.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I get cabin fever at the best of times, but I don't think I suffer nearly as much as the two of you. Hannes, so you spent a lot of the time down at the coast. You're back up in Gauteng in Pretoria. How's it been for you these last couple of weeks?
I am back indeed, and at least back at home, and everything is familiar to me, and I can bri on my stoop and do what I want, but I can't really do what I want because life is not the same, you know. So being stuck at home is one thing. Like Valdo said, not being able to cross borders is a huge thing for us. I mean, we're the type of people that on a weekly basis, you know, used to travel to either Sabi and Mpumalanga or wherever, or Clarence or somewhere. You know, we're not used to being at home for longer than a week at a time. So it's really, I'm struggling from that point of view as well.
Valdo, you said that you have been able to work a little bit, and we've spoken about it often on the show. Apart from being motoring journalists, the two of you host the very well-known motoring TV show, Lutwiel. So you've been able to get onto the road, albeit not as much as you'd like.
No, not nearly as much as we'd like. But, you know, we've also got to respect the rule of law and you know, take care with the virus, because it is a serious situation and we've got to take it seriously. So, you know, as much as we'd like to get out there and do more, we also understand that this is the way that things are at the moment. So we comply as much as we can, and we work to the letter of the law, and we do what we can, but it certainly isn't enough to satisfy the wanderlust, that's for sure.
Voldu, you and I were trying to work out how many briars Hannes Visser has had in his lifetime. I can imagine it's up the ante. Hannes, being on lockdown, it's afforded you plenty of opportunities to bri even more. What was that original number we came up with in terms of brying in your lifetime?
I don't know what number you came up with, but I can tell you what I did the last 21 days since I've been back from the coast. At an average of about 1.5 bries a day. So some days I've had two and at least one a day. So for the last 21 days, I probably had about 25 or 27.
I was going to say, I'm glad you said over the course of 20. I was trying to work out what constitutes half a braai.
Well, just averages.
Yeah, I
know. If you divide them into the days.
Okay, well, yeah, welcome back to the show, everyone, and to my two guests. And, yeah, as mentioned, we can see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. So let's hold thumbs that it does end soon. But without further ado, let's get into the show. So this episode is about one car and one car only, well, one brand. And it was about 2 weeks ago where I got a WhatsApp from Voldu and Hannes. So we've got a group chat pretty much every day about all sorts of things, mostly cars and other rubbish. And Hannes and Voldu gave me the news, what they were about to take on for that entire day. And you couldn't have got a more jealous person than myself. And also a friend of ours, Ray, who's also on the group. But the two men that were living the dream, especially during lockdown, were Hannes and Voldu. Hannes, talk us through a little bit of how that day kicked off.
Well, it kicked off with a meeting with the PR people from Lamborghini at their flagship Johannesburg dealership in Melrose Arch. We started there about 6 in the morning. It was still dark. The lights were on inside, and inside were there were two cars parked there, Lamborghini Huracan Evo, the latest one, as well as the Lamborghini Urus SUV. And we could see them from outside the window. Then we were forced to put up to put on our face masks to go inside. We climbed into the two cars and drove off with masks over our faces in a combined value of 9 million rands worth of cars. And we felt like we stole them.
Oh, man. I mean, what is it feeling like, Voldu, climbing into a brand new Lamborghini off the floor where everyone else has to be locked up, confined into their houses, very few people out on the road? Firstly, you're able to get out onto the road. Secondly, you're able to do so. And it almost, saying a car almost does it a disservice. It's getting out into the road in this magnificent machine.
Oh, it truly is magnificent machines, or are both of them. The thing is, Derek, that regardless of the situation surrounding the quiet roads and being able to get out and cabin fever, the reality is that getting into something as special as a Lamborghini is always an experience, regardless of what's going on around you. You know, you get into the cabin and it feels alien because it's, you know, after all these years, Hannes and I have gotten used to driving just about anything. You get into a car, you can close your eyes and say, this is a BMW, or this is a VW, or this is a Toyota, or whatever. You just know them by touch and you know how things work. You get into a Lamborghini, which is so exclusive that you have to orient yourself a little bit and just figure out how things work and where things are, and the smells are different, and certainly the look and feel of everything. It's just, it's such an overwhelming experience when you first get into one of those.
And Hannes, it goes without saying, the storied history when it comes to Lamborghini. And I mean, we were speaking off air. You know, it wasn't always the case for Lamborghini where it came with this magnificent reputation.
No. Lamborghini's got a very colorful history. Ferruccio Lamborghini in his day actually built tractors to start off with. And then he decided to turn his tractors, well, not didn't turn them into sports cars, but then he started to build proper sports cars. But they were rough, you know, they were very beautiful to look at, but they weren't sophisticated at all. And they broke down all the time up till Diablos about 15, 20 years ago. I had the pleasure of driving a Diablo for Latville, and it broke down twice in one day 10 years ago. So, and then, of course, the Germans took it over and they really refined Lamborghini. So today we sit with modern, high-quality sports cars that still look the part. And that's a fantastic combination. But it's true what Walter said about you have to just familiarize yourself with the interior. The Urus and the Huracan, very, very different inside. You know, it's hard to say that they're both Lamborghinis because they differ so much. But I found myself looking for the gear lever in the Lamborghini, and it's automatic, obviously, in the Huracan. And it only had a neutral and a reverse. I couldn't find drive, and they had to come and help me, and say all I have to do is pull on the lever behind the steering wheel that selects the gear. So it took me about 10 seconds to get going.
I've got to sit back though. When you said you first took out the Diablo when you're doing it for Latville, and it broke down twice in the course of a day, what exactly happened? And how did you get out of the mess?
Well, I was driving it around Zwartkops at the time, and in the fast sweep, I think it's called turn 4 or 5 at Zwartkops, I just lost control and the car spun out. And then when we got out, it dumped 12 liters of oil through its sump onto the left rear wheel. We had to get a flatbed to recover the car and take it back to its owner. It wasn't pleasant.
Well, thankfully, you didn't have any issues this time around. Voldu, firstly, what did you get to drive, and how was the initial reaction?
Derek, I was in the Urus most of the day. I did get a little spin in the Huracan, but Hannes and I split the two, and I was in the taller car of the two. Initial reaction was you know, quite a bit clenchy, actually, of the cheeks, because, you know, they gave us the keys and said drive safely, but the cars were still parked on the showroom floor. So the step one is to move a 3.5 million rand car through the narrow doors of the dealership. And you don't want to get that wrong in the first 2 meters, you know. So anyway, after that, you know, just getting out on the road, adjusting the seats, the mirrors and everything, getting everything ready. Quite an experience. And I didn't dare boot it until the engine had warmed up nicely and so on. But maybe I should tell you about that just a little bit later. Believe me, it was quite an experience.
And your initial experience getting into the Huracan and driving off, Hannes, were you also a little nervous getting out those doors?
Yeah, because it's so low to the ground that you can't really see all that much. You know, it's a sports car. It's not a practical thing. So you have to make sure that you familiarize yourself with the environment before you before you go. And like Waldo said, you take a bit of time just to adjust the seat and get everything ready, and then off we went. And from that moment on, it was all about the sound and the gearbox. And even at slow speed, the sound, you know, it's got a mode where you can choose between normal driving and sport, and then it's got a setting for Corsa, which of course is racetrack. And it didn't take me long to find the Corsa button, and I drove it on Corsa for the rest of the day because it just wakens the car up. Every noise, every gear change, everything is more racy, more sporty.
For every man sitting at home and every woman, I mean, it's very few people get to experience what you gents did over the course of that day. And you speak about the sights, the sounds, the smell. I mean, elaborate a bit more. I mean, getting into it, you said you've experienced pretty much everything there is to experience when it comes to cars, but try and paint a picture for us, Hannes, just sitting inside that, albeit fairly uncomfortably, because you're not the smallest of fellows, and as you said, as a sports car, it isn't primed for comfort, but everything else, it just absolutely explodes in terms of sensation.
Yeah, Derek, we often joke and say that at our age, we prefer cars that you must climb into and fall out of. You know, that's easier and more convenient than the ones you have to fall into and climb out of. But for something like a Huracan, I'm more than willing to make that exception. It literally, you know, it's you fall into the thing and you're literally just a few inches off the ground. But then the car sort of, it sort of forms around you and you become one with it. And the feeling of the steering wheel in your hands and just your feet on the pedal, everything becomes one. I don't know how to describe it. You become one being with the thing. And then, of course, after that, if you get onto the open road and you start nailing it a little bit, whatever, it just responds. And that's what a sports car is supposed to do. It responds to every single little input so much better than a normal car. You know, it happens instantly. Whatever you want the car to do, it does. And in a Lamborghini, it does it so, so well that you feel like you're a Formula One driver. And then, of course, that sound and just going through the gears and the acceleration, whatever. I'm not going to say how fast we took it on the day, but it accelerates really, really fast. 0-100 in under 3 seconds, I think it's 2.8 or something like that. I mean, 2.8, 3 seconds, you don't feel the difference. Anything under 3 is exceptionally fast. That's super car quick.
Oh, 0-100 in 3 seconds. And that's where you stayed, obviously, at 100.
Well, I went to 129.
Okay, that's okay, cool. A little over the limit, but good boy. Talk us through your route in Gauteng. Did you get to be able to experience it to its max capabilities with regards to the terrain that you drove on?
Well, it's always limiting shooting in Gauteng because, number one, Gauteng is not the prettiest place or doesn't give the prettiest backdrops, especially in winter, which is now coming up. So it's always you know, there's not many colors or nice backgrounds. We would have preferred to take the cars to Mpumalanga maybe or somewhere where it's open and so on. But we did find a private piece of road that we did cordon off, and we did enjoy the car to its fullest, yes.
Oh, geez, I'm sure you did. The interior, I'm looking through images, and you guys did send me a few as well. Not too many of the interior. I saw plenty of the outside, which, of course, is absolutely stunning. But having a look through the web, and highly impressed with the interior. I think they've certainly jazzed it up a bit over the years.
They absolutely have, and that's the German influence. Sorry for Mr. Lamborghini, but the Germans refined the Lamborghini brand, and that's why you now have a modern, ultra-luxurious and reliable sports car in the form of the Huracan.
Yeah, it certainly is modern, but from a technical point of view, I mean, all the glitzy gadgets seem to be there too.
It's got everything, you know. It's got the airplane type switches to switch off and on the lights and the wipers and all of those things. And there are no stalks behind the steering wheel, which I initially found a little strange. The indicator is on a button on the left-hand side of the steering wheel, but it's a small little button, almost like a motorbike, that you have to press to the left or right to put the indicator on. And that's the only thing that I didn't like about the interior. The rest is all spot on.
There are no stalks behind the steering wheel, but there's there's a driving gear behind the steering wheel.
Well, yeah, it's a big battle to switch up gears, yeah.
Okay, Valdo, let's move over to you quick. Of course, we're staying with Lamborghini. You got to sample that Urus, and what were your impressions? You said you'd get into it a little later. Now's the time. Tell us more.
Well, Derek, you know, it's difficult to fathom, but the Urus has even more power than the Huracan. It weighs quite a bit more as well. It's a 2.2-ton vehicle. So, you know, it needs a little bit more grunt, but then it gets from 0 to 100 in about 3.6 seconds. If you think about a 2.2 ton car accelerating that fast, it is simply astounding. And the soundtrack that goes with it is simply astounding too. It varies a little bit from the Huracan in terms of the running gear. It's built on a different platform, and we'll get into that shortly. But you know, it's got a twin turbo engine, which is the first time that Lamborghini's actually gone to a twin turbo option. Some people will recognize the engine is similar to the one that's used in something like the Porsche Cayenne turbo. And while the engine uses the same block, it's got completely reworked cylinder heads and so on, and it actually produces 100 horsepower, 76 kilowatts more than the Porsche Cayenne turbo does. So that's a hell of a lot of power. And to have that under your command is such a great feeling. And the soundtrack to me tops everything. I have to admit that the soundtrack in the Huracan is probably just a little bit better. But in an SUV, I've never heard anything like that before in my life. And I enjoyed absolutely every moment. You can't begin to explain how quickly this thing picks up speed. It really is just astounding.
Did you also experience a similar level of speed that Hannes enjoyed in terms of getting to the top speed? And did you stay there as well on the limit or a little bit more?
No, you know, to me, the biggest thing with the car was to see how it handled. The Huracan is all about speed. The Urus, to me, was more about a 2.2-ton Lamborghini. Does it still handle like a Lamborghini? So we found a little bit of an S-bend on a private piece of road that was blocked off. And I got to throw it around there quite a bit. And I can happily report that it handles like a scalpel. It's just unbelievable. Well, saying that, the first time I went into the bend, I did turn off all the safety systems, thinking it's a four-wheel drive. And I went in a little bit quicker than I probably should have. And I had experienced another clenching moment as all four wheels lost a bit of traction, and it was a bit of a fight to regain control over a 3.5 million rand Lamborghini. After that, I did tone it back a little bit, but it certainly still handles exactly the way that you would expect, if not better.
We all know.
I'm proud of you, Bobby. You admitted that you were quite spirited this morning.
I was more than a bit spirited. I simply couldn't believe that a car like that, that big, that tall, could actually handle. To me, it instilled more confidence than many of the other sports cars I've driven in my life, lower and flatter sports cars. It really felt with a Urus like you could throw it around. I think maybe the fact that it wasn't my car helped a little bit with that confidence. But then I know Mr. Fenter and Mr. Kruger at Lamborghini quite well, and I don't think it would have been wise to stick it into the scenery either.
Now, I mean, we all know how the need and the trend in SUVs has exploded over the last decade. Seems everyone has one. And I can imagine a lot of people who are Lamborghini historians and absolute addicts would be saying, why convert it into an SUV? Is there a need for it? And I mean, clearly by your experience, you said it doesn't really matter. The fact is you enjoyed it immensely.
Well, the thing is that not many people realize it, but this is not actually Lamborghini's first foray into the sort of leisure four-wheel drive area. They actually built a vehicle called the LM002 many, many, many years ago. It was built between 1986 and 1993 or four, if I remember correctly. They only built about 330 odd of these very, very ugly pickup trucks that was powered by the same V12 that you got in the Lamborghini Countach. So, you know, it's not entirely new territory for them, but I think the best is to just forget about the LM002. It was ugly and unsuccessful.
It's chalk and cheese between those two. I mean, it's not about far removed cousins. I mean, we're not even talking about the same same ballpark.
But that brings us onto the modern cousins, because the reality is that Lamborghini now belongs to the VW Group. And the VW Group has the MLB platform. It's a German abbreviation. It stands for Modulare Langsbach Aston, I think, something like that. I don't think I did that very well. Anyway, it's a modular longitudinal matrix in English. And really, like we spoke about in previous episodes, it's just a technological platform that underpins these cars. So as a result, the Urus is built on the same technological platform as vehicles like the VW Touareg and the Bentley Bentayga, the Audi Q7, and of course the Porsche Cayenne that we spoke about earlier. So it makes sense to bring the cousin into the family as well, you know, for Lamborghini. Mm. And if you look at what the Porsche Cayenne did for the futures of Porsche, it absolutely makes sense to sort of defocus a little bit and bring a sports SUV or then a super SUV into the family as well.
Yeah, it really is a beautiful looking car. And I mean, moving many, many, many miles away from that LM002, I mean, it, as mentioned, it's chalk and cheese, but yeah, it looks stunning from the outside.
It's just gorgeous to look at. And the nice thing is that it goes the way that you'd expect. It handles the way you expect. And now you can take four friends with you. You can go five up in it if you have to. I'd say four is really the magic number for it. And then it's still got space for luggage and so on. It really is a practical supercar.
Yeah. I mean, price-wise, of course, you're looking at a very, very niche market when you're looking at your buyers here, Voldu.
Yeah, it's certainly not a car that's open to everyone. But then very few of the vehicles built on the MLB platform is, if you think about it. I think the cheapest of them is probably the Touareg. And then it just goes northwards from there until you get to Urus and Bentayga territory, which is quite a lot of money, 3.5 million rand for a sporty SUV. On the flip side, you get something that you can't get anywhere else. The Urus simply has no competition at the moment. There's nothing that comes even close to it. Even its sporty cousin, the Cayenne Turbo, is simply blown away by the performance of this Lambo. So, you know, you're in a different league with this vehicle. And the other thing is that cars like that tend to hold their value quite well. So, you know, you could spend a lot less and buy a Toyota Fortuner. Well, those actually also held their value. But, you know, the Lamborghini is a special vehicle, and it's something that will hold its value quite well, I think.
And you say nothing comes close to this. I mean, are you talking about across the board? There's nothing where you thought, I'd probably enjoy this part of the car more if I was sitting in that Cayenne? Or is this top the pops in every single sphere?
No, to me, there is absolutely nothing that comes close to it. I mean, I would love to drive a Porsche Cayenne Turbo every day of my life, and it's only 1 second slower out of the blocks. But then it's not quite a Lamborghini, is it?
Nah, it's not. And
if I could just chip in here on that note to confirm what Voldo is saying.
Chip in with everything.
It really is a Lamborghini. I mean, it's a SUV, but now you can share Lamborghini sports car feeling and handling with the family. And that's something that's never, no one's ever been able to do. I mean, you get other sporty SUVs like the Maserati and so on. And like, you know, the Porsche Cayenne is probably one of the best, if not the best all-rounder out there. But this is a Lamborghini and it's an SUV. I mean, it's just two words you've never been able to put in the same sentence. And now you really, really can, because it is literally the best of both worlds.
Well, you could have shared the LM002 at the family.
No.
You could, but the family wouldn't get into
no,
it.
No, that's the problem.
It was very, very ugly.
No, it's a hideous-looking car. No offense to Lamborghini. But, yeah, they certainly have upped their game a lot over the preceding years. But, yeah, Hannes, going back to you at the Hurricane, I mean – yeah, we keep on singing the car's praises, and rightly so. I mean, it's hard to fault anything. I certainly can't just by looking at it, and by the signs of things, by driving it, it just gets even better.
Well, these are those type of cars. They're halo cars. I mean, they cost 5.5 million rand for a reason. You know, you get what you pay for, and the Hurricane is that. It's actually difficult to believe that the Hurricane is Lamborghini's entry-level sports car. At the moment, as everyone knows, in the past, they had the Gallardo as the entry-level sports car, and the Murcielago was the top one, and now it's the Hurricane as the entry-level. And then the Aventador, of course, is the flagship sports car. But anyway, the Hurricane Evo has got a few evolution. They added a few bits and pieces to it and gave it more power. So, yeah, the name 640, of course, refers to horsepower, and that's 470 kilowatts. And Valdo's Urus has got 478 kilowatts from the twin turbo. But this 470 kilowatts in the Hurricane is, of course, from a 5.2-liter V10, naturally aspirated. So that in itself is just pure sports car heaven.
Oh, Derek, can I just pop in here quickly? Because, you know, the numbers are very similar between the two cars, even though the Urus has slightly more. The reality is that we're looking at cars that have between, you know, close to 500 kilowatts. Yeah, 500 kilowatts. Just think about that for a little bit. You know, that is 300 kilowatts more than a Golf GTI, which is by all means seen as a fairly rapid hot hatch. That's 300 kilowatts more. It's almost three times the power of one of those cars. It makes a BMW M3 look fairly pedestrian in terms of power output. So the thing is that people often fixate on 0 to 100 times. And yes, those are important. Once you get under 3 seconds, you're in hypercar territory. You're going pretty fast. But the way you really feel it is when you go from 150 to 200 or from 200 to 250. That's where the depth of power really comes to the fore. And certainly the little squirt that I had with the Huracan, you know, I had my cheeks going backwards and in a wry smile the whole time until I hit the brakes. And just the sheer depth of power, it really does feel like it's connected to the horizon with a very long piece of elastic.
Oh. Derek, it's all about power to weight. So the Urus has got 478 kilowatts, but like Waldo said, it's 2.2 tons, which is exceptional for an SUV. But now to put it into sports car terms, the 470 kilowatts in the Huracan, that weighs only 1.4 tons, which means it's around 330 kilowatts per ton. And that is where you get your supercar performance from. Mm. Just to put it also in perspective, I think a Formula One car nowadays has got about 600 kilowatts. These things have got 470, so not that far off. Okay, they're a little bit heavier, but that puts it into perspective. I mean, you can drive it every day.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I mean, we heard Voldu's take on the Urus, pretty much faultless. Anything that you could find fault with regards to what you were driving, the Huracan?
Just that it's not parked in my garage.
Oh, man.
We had to give it back, and this is where the story got really weird. We, unlike car thieves, we put our masks back on and returned the cars on the same day. Unfortunately, that was quite weird. But yeah, no, it's those kind of things, Derek, that you want. You know, as little boys, we had posters of these things on our walls. Mm. Okay, they were Countaches and Diablos back then. And if I was a little boy now, then these would be the cars that you'd have a poster of on your wall. That's what they are like.
And I suppose one of the biggest disappointments being able to drive these things during lockdown, and that you could, well, it's a benefit in one, in that, of course, the roads are far more open. But the other thing is that there aren't many people around to look, and you can't sit there with this massive smile on your face as the public look on envious.
Yeah, these are the extreme boulevard cruisers, in addition to their power capabilities. You know, you want to be seen in them. And it was quite sad not to be seen, but we're hoping to at least show it to all the viewers on the television show. So, you know, there's a little bit of solace in that at least. But it's not the same. It's not quite the same.
Oh, I really can't wait.
When you go to the Lamborghini dealership, they've got all the different options and colors and trims and whatever that you can choose for your car, the different trim leather and colors and all of that. And I can just imagine what a fantastic feeling it must be to be able to walk in there, order your car, and then go through the whole process of picking all the trims and colors and spec levels that you want to suit you. I mean, that must be one of the most amazing motoring experiences available to man.
And just finally, going on regarding the storied history of Lamborghini, I love the naming convention when it comes to Lambo, Hannes.
So Mr. Ferruccio Lamborghini obviously had a thing for Spanish bullfighting, because just about every single Lamborghini or model, whatever, that was ever made has got a connection to Spanish bullfighting. So to give an idea, the name Diablo was apparently a vicious fighting bull from 1869. Murcielago was also a fighting bull from 1879. Apparently, his life was spared. And Gallardo, for instance, is a name of an entire bull race. Not only one bull, but a whole race of them. And Aventador is a well-known fighting bull that fought as recently as 1993. So, yeah, all of them have got a strong connection to fighting bulls. Urus is the ancestor of the modern cattle as we know today.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've got all these fighting bulls, Voldo, and then you got the ancestor of some cattle.
Yeah, it's a bit of a letdown in terms of the name, but believe me, it makes up for it everywhere else. Eh? If that's cattle class, I'm happy to go cattle class.
Your highlight?
Who, mine?
Yeah. Everything.
Absolutely bloody everything. Yeah, I don't know. I think probably the little button that lets you choose the drive mode and flipping that thing from Strada, which is normal highway, into Corsa, which is race. and everything tightens up, tenses, the gearbox changes, everything. So my highlight would be flipping that little switch.
Low light, should I even ask? Nothing.
Yeah, well, there's an obvious low light. I had to give it back.
Yeah. and again, your let's drive out of five, I can pretty much predict what this is going to be too.
Well, you're wrong, eh? It's probably a six.
Yeah, no, I did predict that. I won't lie. Hannes, highlight?
Every time you change gears with your foot flat, just the way that it hooks that next gear and pushes you back in the seat, that whole feeling of power and oh god, that putting your foot down and changing gears.
No, I'm not going to ask you a low light. We've already established that. And score, you're going to go with Voldo, a maximum over the ropes.
No, you can't otherwise. I mean, this is the pinnacle of sports cars. I mean,
oh, beautiful. The land of Lamborghini. Thanks, gents. That was the Hurricane and the Urus. Live in the moment till I die. Now, moving on to Toyota Gazoo Racing South Africa. This is a man who's done exceptionally well in the racing world, and it wasn't too long ago where he was asked to navigate. It was unfamiliar territory to him because he's been known to be a superstar when it comes to two wheels and four wheels to an extent. But Brett Cummins on the line, welcome to the show. How was it taking to the navigator's seat over the course of your more recent career?
How's it, guys? It was definitely a shell shock. It was definitely different to what we were used to being on the bike and navigating for yourself. You're going at breakneck speeds with a guy like Henk in the driver's seat, and it's definitely a culture shock.
Yeah, so talk us through how this came about. You mentioned Henk. We talk about Henk Latakane, the very established driver for Toyota Gazoo Racing South Africa in the cross-country series. And, yeah, I mean, was it something that you didn't expect whatsoever when you got that call from Glenn Hall, team principal of Toyota Gazoo Racing SA?
Yeah, I was actually rather surprised. It was last year, I think it was around about February, when I got a missed call from Glenn. And, I thought he might have dialed me by mistake when he did call, and then I called him back. That's when he said, there's this opportunity. Would I be keen? I said, yeah, I'm keen. I just want to maybe set up a session, meet up with Henk, and obviously meet up with him to see what the expectations are. And as it would be, the expectations are nothing less than going out to win. So, it was you can't even explain the extremity of that excitement that came through.
Gary, can I just jump in here and just say that call was not a mistake at all. It was a very carefully planned call made by Glenn Hall, who knows his motorsport. And Brett is a very reserved person and modest and down-to-earth. I think, Brett, I don't expect you to blow steam up your own backside, but please tell the people exactly what your Dakar experience is, because I don't think everyone knows.
Before he does, I want to just go back. I think it was 2014, hey, Voldu, when we covered a Dakar, and Brett was competing in the Mali Moto category. And, I mean, Glenn Hall has been a fan of yours, Brett, for many, many years. And Voldu, we'll never forget coming back to SA, and immediately the team held a press conference regarding their performance at Dakar over in South America. And out of character, Glenn actually singled out Brett and his performance in Mali Moto, which had nothing to do with what the press conference was about. I mean, that's how highly he rated this man.
I think a big part of that, and sorry, Brett, if I talk behind your back a little bit as if you're not here, but the reality is that we saw Brett every day coming into the bivouac during that Dakar. We got in a little bit behind him because the bikes were on the road earlier. And by the time we got in, Derek, you and I, together with our colleagues, Brett was already showered, cleaned, his bike was serviced, everything was ready for the next day. And this is like halfway through the day when most of the other riders taking part in what was then Mali Moto were still struggling to get back to the bivouac. And Brett just always seemed absolutely composed. He'd come down and chat with everyone. And I think that made a hell of a good impression on Glenn and all of us, really. To see someone that can take on something that tough and manage himself to the degree where he's completely in control throughout. And that also brings me a little bit to what you said earlier, because, you know, Brett might have moved into the navigator seat now, but on a bike, there is no navigator. You have to do all of that yourself. So it's not like there was no navigating experience. There was a hell of a lot. It was just a different type of navigating at that stage.
So, Brett, after hearing other guys speak about you, let's hear from you. Tell us about the Dakar experience and how well you did it and how you, how you managed to come to terms with, as Voldu mentioned, looked as if it was just another day in the sun for you. Each and every day, a smile on your face, very relaxed, fresh and ready for the next day's competition.
Yeah, I think it's actually, it's a story that can be told over a couple of years, but it's kind of one of those situations where I got to the point shortly before the Dakar started where I realized I wasn't going to have enough funds. I got hold of the guys and asked them if I could enter into this exclusive class of the Malamoto where you're self-sufficient, because I couldn't afford to pay for any more expenses in the lines of backup crew or mechanic or anything like that. And that's where I sat myself down and, said to myself, I've got to go out there. I'm not going to let anything faze me. I'm not going to let, the situation get to me, and I'm just going to take it as it comes. And I think that kind of attitude sort of allowed me to not get flustered when anything went wrong and just deal with the situation as best as possible.
And you dealt with it extremely well. So how did things finish over in Malamoto?
Relatively well. I think I came second, a minute behind the leader in the Malamoto class, and I think I finished 28th overall. So I couldn't have asked for a better result. I really didn't have those expectations. That to me was one of the highlights of my racing career.
Yeah, and moving forward by about 5 or 6 years to the South African Cross Country Series, you get the call to be a navigator for Henk Latakane. And how has that been?
Yeah, it's actually been good. Henk is an extremely level-headed individual, and although he's a young expert at what he does, he's extremely, cool, calm, and collected, if you want to put it that way. And I think that makes, us work well together. We've got obviously the similar interests and, the similar sort of mindset to make it work. And I couldn't have asked for a better match. I couldn't have asked for a better team to be part of. And it's gone from strength to strength.
Strength to strength. I think you're certainly underplaying it a little bit. It couldn't have been better, Hannes.
No, well, excuse me. They won the South African National Cross Country Championship in their first year together. So, it couldn't have gone any better because they're the champions.
Brett, I mean, going up against the likes of Jeanille de Villiers and from a man who's perfected his craft on two wheels, and it must absolutely blow your mind what you've managed to achieve over the course of the last year and a bit.
Yeah, well, it's definitely been a steep learning curve. I've had the likes of Rob Howie, who's obviously extremely well experienced, and the guidance and the coaching of Glenn himself to take me through this process. And it's thanks to guys like that we've had the success that we've had, and obviously the experience that I gained over the years of navigating for myself. It's obviously been a bit of a challenge of now converting it to the sense of having to explain it to someone else and paint that picture for them while you're doing those astronomical speeds. But it's definitely ended up better than I expected.
You say
these bikers are extremely tough bastards, if I can put it like that. I mean, we see them at Dakar every year. But also remember that bikers make very, very good Dakar competitors in cars as well. If you go back to Mr. Dakar himself, Stefan Pedersen, he first won it on a bike 6 or 7 times before climbing into the four-wheel cars. And he's won it another 5 or 6 times there, you know. So that's Peter Hansel for one. Cyril Depre, who won Dakar, I think, 4 or 5 times as well on a bike. He competed the last 3 or 4 years with Peugeot and won some stages along the way and was a top competitor. And, of course, Mark Homer, the other biking legend, who's also won 5 Dakars, stepped up into the navigator seat of Fernando Alonso's cars, you know, very well. And he's also done a very good job. So, obviously, the recipe of these bikers converting to four-wheel drives to the four-wheel drive cars is a recipe that works, and that's what Glenn Hall saw. And that's why Brett is in that seat, and he's doing a fantastic job.
Brett, you speak about converting your knowledge from being on a bike and navigating for yourself to having to convert to the side. But another word, convincing. How tough is it to convince the driver to listen to every single thing that you have to say? Because we've heard of stories in the past between drivers and navigators where there've been hair-raising arguments between the two of them, where the driver simply refuses to listen. What's the relationship between you and Henk like? And does he take to heart everything you say?
Yeah, I mean, we're still learning as we're going along. And the thing is, when you start getting a certain tone in your voice, I think that's where Henk obviously starts picking up quite well if we're not sort of listening to one another or anything like that. You know, so he'll sort of realize when I've got a sense of urgency in my voice, and I think it's important to react to that. So, yeah, I mean, it all depends on how you keep the situation under control. And as long as you keep the situation under control, you shouldn't be getting into that position where you have to elevate your voice levels or create any sense of urgency in your voice.
And finally, what does the future hold for the two of you? And unfortunately, you can pretty much almost write off 2020 for now, given the impact of COVID-19. But are the two of you looking to go from strength to strength as a pair? And you heard Hannes allude to bikers who have moved over to four wheels and vice versa in terms of Dakar. I mean, could we see you in the driver's seat in the near or far future?
Sheesh, that's something I don't know and I cannot comment on at this point in time. But, you know, I think the first step would be to see if we can try and get an opportunity to go to Dakar together. I think we're a good match. And I think for now, I'll stick to what I'm good at, and Henk should stick to what he's good at.
Oh, lovely. Anything from you two gents, Voldo and Hannes, that you'd like to just catch from Brett?
Just a quick question for Brett from me. Brett, the first time you stepped into the Hilux, what was your reaction to the speed and the type of terrain that you can tackle? Coming from a bike, you obviously approach routes and things completely differently. Was it a big difference?
Yeah, it's massive. I actually had a short opportunity, I think it was in 2014, where I had a drive in a Hilux, but it was a very short stint and it was one event. But obviously driving with Henk, that was, you know, at a different level. And, you know, although navigating for yourself on a bike is extremely different because, you know, if you're uncertain, you've got the throttle in your own hand and you can tap off a little bit and just sort of reassure yourself and reconfirm what you're doing. Whereas in this situation, if you miss a call or if you're behind or whatever the situation is, Henk's foot's in the corner and it doesn't back off. So you've got to get back on track as quickly as possible. But I think the important thing with that is obviously when I am in a situation like that, and that goes back to how we keep the situation under control, I'll calmly sort of inform him that, you know, I'm just off on the road book slightly, and he knows it, and he must sort of read the terrain a little bit better, you know, until we get back online.
Excellent.
Breda, also...
Sorry, Brett, have you ever said to Henk, T-junction, go straight?
No, but I have on one or two occasions said to him, turn left, but you can only go right. But that was a quick error, which we quickly fixed.
Yeah, Brett, I don't think people are able to appreciate just how tough it is being able to go through those plethora of directions and be able to convince the driver next to you to exactly follow your lead. And, I mean, we're talking, I mean, sometimes you'd be going for periods of 2, 3, 4 kilometers where there's absolutely no change in the road book, where it's just straight, when suddenly, yeah, you just hit with 5, 6, 7, 8 different directions in the space of a couple of 100 meters.
Yeah, that makes it a little bit difficult in certain instances. Up in Botswana, we had, you know, I think it was 10K sections where there was no instructions on the road book. And, you know, when you go through sections where there's many instructions, you know, up to 5 or 6 instructions within a kilometer, and then you go to 10K sections where there's nothing, you know, the driver starts getting uncertain and unsure of the situation. And that's where you just sort of got to keep the, you know, the guy, you keep Henk at bay and sort of keep him reassured.
Ah, well, well done. You've done an absolutely sterling job so far. And here's to the best of the future. Just touching on COVID, has there been much communication as when you can kind of expect to be back out on the open road?
No, nothing as yet. You know, obviously Motorsport South Africa or SACCS has been communicating of events that have been postponed and cancelled and what have you. So there's no indication of anything as such. But I'm sure, you know, once we get to the lower levels of the lockdowns, we'll get better indication of what's happening. But for now, we'll keep ourselves confined to our environments that we're meant to be kept in and try and keep as fit and healthy as we can for now.
Well, Brett, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. And yeah, we hope to see you out on the road soon. So wrapping up with our Let's Drive Top 5, great year from Brett Cummins. But now I want to hear from Voldu and Hannes once again. We dealt with a pretty good SUV up front. I want to hear about the top 5 SUVs that you've experienced over the course of your motoring lifetimes. Let's start with Voldu. You go first.
Well, that's very easy to start. It would have to be the Lamborghini Urus.
Okay. Of the shock, horror, shock. Hannes.
Well, it's actually an easy one. I'm going to keep it in the family. Porsche Cayenne.
Okay. Ooh, going the big guys. Okay. Moving on to number 3. Voldu.
It has to be the Range Rover Autobiography SVR, top of the pops, Range Rover version vehicle. Just so competent. It goes anywhere and it goes like stink as well.
Okay, so we've got the Urus, the Cayenne, the Range Rover SUV. And moving to Hannes, number 4.
Well, we actually spoiled for choice when it comes to quality SUVs, but no list will be complete without a Land Cruiser 200 that can go anywhere and in style and comfort.
Land Cruiser 200, so that's making up 4. For number 5, I'm going to go back to you, Voldy, and I know that you're going to go for that LM002.
I am not, because it's not on the list. I am going to pop a little flyer in there and say that probably the most competent SUV that I've experienced hands-on in my own hands and harnesses has to be a Toyota Fortuner. We've covered from 2014 until 2020, Dakars in them. We've driven on dunes, rocks, in riverbeds, mountain passes, almost got killed, survived. It just is as good as it gets for a car that most people can afford.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in there too, because if I was afforded a pick, I would have taken that one too. So yeah, that wraps it up. Urus, Cayenne, Range Rover, Land Cruiser 200, Toyota Fortuner. And that wraps up the show. Thanks for joining us on Let's Drive. We'll see you soon. Cheers.